Mr. Jewett, Reel 15. This is your first contact with the Russians. Were they friendly?
Oh, yes, they were quite friendly. They couldn't speak a word of English. In fact, their English was just about as good as our Russian. But they came aboard, and a lot of us bought from them. I picked up a wonderful fur hat. I traded a watch that didn't work. They were quite happy about that. I told him, I said, it didn't work. You know, one of those watches that you wound up and it went round and round and round. The balance wheel was out of it, you know. But for that, I got a beautiful fur hat. It was a magnificent thing. The real I am, but came round your cheeks, and it was absolutely, you know, turned down. So I did all right. But yes, they were very, very friendly, and they had women on their ships. We went alongside one of their Russian oilers, and they had women aboard, and that surprised us, you know, because you know what sailors are. I fancy got women aboard. But as I say, the experience of it all was that my memory is very hazy now, actually, over the years, because we went ashore and nothing cost us any money. We just went ashore, but we were tipped. We kept ourselves to ourselves and didn't bother much with the Russian people. But we couldn't. It wasn't quite the same as America, you know. It was a different ball game. But there it is. The ammunition ship got.
How is a convoy?
By the way, at the end of this convoy, we had literally no ammunition left. We'd fired every damn shell we had, and we were in fact reduced to firing low-angle projectiles to an aircraft. You know, the aircraft didn't know that, but they'd probably got one or two whistling. None of them hit them, but they would have disintegrated the.
Did you have any casualties on board the ship?
No, we didn't. The Shanty was a most amazing ship. I think they didn't have one casualty through the whole of the war, let alone out when I was aboard her. So the Shanty, so that juju must have been pretty powerful, I think. But
can you tell me how a convoy was organised at sea?
Well, yes, I told you all these line of ships were there, but what Onslow did and all the other convoys, they sort of rustled them up into three lines of line ahead, into three lines, and they're sort of a couple of cables length of distance, and the destroyers sort of act as like sheepdogs, if you know what I mean. They're like sheep, and the destroyers are like sheepdogs. They rustle them up, and sometimes they were very slow, and I remember the trick that the destroyer captains used to say was, it's always the last ship that gets it, you know, and you'd see that all of a sudden they put a bit of speed on, because otherwise they would straggle out too far, you see, but they'd keep them boxed in the box formation. That's what normally happens, as far as I could see, but I rather fancy this was organised, not by at our level, but, you know, at Admiralty level for formations of convoys, but they went in formation, and of course the trick was they had to do what is known as zigzag courses to avoid. They'd be on course, whatever it was, and then they'd alter course to starboard or to port, but so many degrees and zigzag. You see, well, the whole of the convoy had to do that, not just a couple of ships. I think it was a pretty, and they used to practice this very often on the way towards. When they first left Iceland, you know, and they still went towards the thing. They used to do some zigzagging all the time, and it does work being a zigzag, because if you're pointing a particular direction and you're sighted, and the anticipating, if they would anticipate, like in so many hours, you would be at a certain point at that direction, and you weren't in that direction, you'd change to maybe a difference of 20 degrees, then of course it meant that you were going in another direction. Of course, that is so the zigzag system, as far as I can see, did work. That's how the convoy was sort of organised. You know,
how much time between zigzags? You know, between
that varied. That varied. You know, it wasn't zigzagging constantly. It was zigzagging. They'd order course and then. They'd flash to the whole of the fleet, you know, the merchant fleet as well, at such and such a time, order course to whatever thing. They'd all order course, and then they'd fly, go on that for so long, and then they'd come back to the course, and it would be plotted, you see, by the master ship, you see, that would send out to. It wasn't all prearranged. It was sent out by signal to each of the ships.
And presumably this would be also a fixed speed, was it?
Yes, convoy speed. It wasn't very fast, actually. They're usually about 8 to 10 knots.
What happened
most.
With vessels that had breakdowns or straggled, so, you know, they just couldn't keep up?
That's right. That's what they called tough. We couldn't allow any... we couldn't spare any that they had to make their own way. But presumably they would turn back or get help somehow or other, but we didn't have enough escorts to
be. But no escort would stay with
that
vessel.
No, not under those circumstances. They might have later on in such things as the mortar convoy, which is a different ball game.
During a sustained air attack, are the columns maintained or do the ships scatter?
Well, they maintain skims. They only scattered once, that one convoy, and it was disastrous. It was a disastrous convoy when they all got lost. Just about, I think everyone got lost. And but that was when they scattered. It was a terrible thing that. But no, they used to maintain their line. They used to keep together. And they had, of course, on each of these merchant ships, they had close range weapons, aircraft weapons. You know, they used to put up a good. In fact, they were very dangerous because. They would fire at anything that moved, you know. Those lads on the merchant ships, they were trained with close range weapons such as Bofors. They didn't have Oerlikons, but they had Oerlikons rather, no Bofors, sorry, and close range weapons, 0.5s, I think.
And I believe they were army gunners, actually.
Oh, DEMS ratings, yes, they were. They were put on later on in the convoys, not straight away. There were DEMS, defensively equipped merchant ships. They were called DEMS ratings. They were army gunners who were sailors on the merchant ships. And a convoy could put a pretty good barrage up, believe you me. When they came down, they were all they're pretty brave blokes, those Germans. They made a mistake about that. They were fighting for their cause.
Who was in overall command of the convoy?
Well, in a convoy, a large convoy, it would be the commodore. And in this particular convoy, it was our man, Captain Onslow, who was Captain D, and he would be in charge of the convoy. But they would have a commodore. Like most convoys would be on a cruiser, a light cruiser. Later on, they had light cruisers, not heavy. And he would be the commodore in charge of the convoy, you know. And they had and they did start to bring an aircraft. What do they call them? Aircraft carriers, aircraft carriers, you know, the later on, you know, the banana boats things, you know. Arania was called one, began with an A, I can't remember. Arania, they started bringing them up later, in later convoys. But it was no fun at all, apart from when, you know, the fact the ration problems, which were, I mean, you always had hard tack, you know, and hot meals were not very often. But it's quite on a ship like a destroyer, it's quite amazing to see the rain. When it was rough, it starts, the weather comes in, you get heavy weather. But heavy weather's a good thing because the aircraft can't fly in heavy weather. A German aircraft can't fly in heavy weather, and the submarines have problems as well because it distracts the course of the submarines. They don't seem to have much fun in the heavy weather either, because it's turbulence under the surfaces. It works works both ways, you know.
Were there submarines? Was there submarine attacks on this particular convoy?
On this particular convoy, yes, there were. There were two or three, but not as heavy as later convoys. Later convoys, you've got. They started packs. The Germans started hunting in packs, and this meant that all of a sudden you get a sudden attack of about, or you suddenly see about four ships get torpedoed at the same time. Bang, 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 bang. It's a sorry sight seeing these ships, as I told you, there were a blaze and they were smoking and all the rest of it. and they were pretty nasty sights. But on one occasion, we had a we took up on the Ashanti, we took up what the one ton, what it was called the 1 ton depth charge, and we had to fire this depth. It was fired from the torpedo tube. They took one of the tubes out, the torpedoes out, and they fired this 1 ton depth charge from the torpedo tube on the Ashanti. And it was a tremendous bang, because we fired it at high speed. As soon as there was, the Aztecs detected them, you see, these submarines, where they were, and there was a group coming that were in position, and they dropped this depth charge. Great grief, what a bang. I think the whole of the blooming fleet felt it was an absolutely enormous bang. And I didn't see them, but they told me that there were submarines surfacing about 5 miles away, sort of thing. They were really, they really did have an effect, but I only saw the one on the one occasion.
Were you able to carry out any attack on submarines on this particular convoy, your first one?
No, we didn't. We swept when there was whenever there's a submarine attack, you try to kill it. You see, you sweep it. But one of the things we got introduced to up there was what the sailors used to comically call the homosexual torpedo. And the homosexual torpedo was because it always clouted you up the backside. And it was because it was the acoustic torpedo, the German acoustic torpedo. That was, they came out on the Russian convoys. And it was attracted, the torpedo was attracted to the turbulence of the propeller, of a ship's propeller. The acoustics of the ship's propeller attracted the German torpedo. And so they had to fix this up, all up with what they called foxes. Now, a foxer was a device which they streamed from the stern of the ships, and it made an enormous vibrating sound, so that when the Germans fired these acoustic torpedoes, instead of going to the torpedo, to the propeller, it went to the foxer, which was about 50 yards astern, you see. And that actually worked as well. Pretty crafty people, the Germans, and we're pretty crafty people at getting out of these things. This happened with a magnetic mine, as you know, as I think I've told you. You know, a very clever device, but it was got over with the degaussing gear of all the ships. So they have the sort of the comings and goings of the war. But
after this particular convoy, did you take empty ships back?
Yes, there were. After the ships, we mustered all the empty ships and go on the return journey. But the Germans didn't used to bother so much on the return journey, because I think they realised that they were empty, and that they might sink the ship, but that they wouldn't get any cargo. I mean, the ones that really, they had to concentrate all their resources on the full ships going up to Russia, because I'm convinced to this day that those Russian convoys were had a great influence on the outcome of the war, because the Russians couldn't have sustained the war against the Germans had they not had a great deal of help from the Americans and from us, of course, but principally the Americans. Up to this very day, I mean, it was one of the things that nobody seems to want to talk about in the strategy of the Second World War, but I'm sure that was a fact. Those sailors who lost their lives on Russian convoys, and believe me, there were thousands, were just as important to the war effort as Stalingrad or anywhere like that, because that's where they got the things from.
Did you say that as an escort you took the convoy from the when you picked it up? Right through to Murmansk,
right,
or Archangel.
Yes, right through.
And the behind your convoy, you'd have this cover group.
Yeah, we never saw them, but we assumed they were
did
there.
Did they all go right through, or did they turn?
No, they never. We never saw them. They didn't go into Murmansk or Archangel. Not that I saw anyway. I didn't see any.
You mentioned the fact that aircraft came out to meet you from the Russian soil.
Yes, to escort us on the last couple of miles, yes.
Have the Russian fleet come out to escort you?
Once, yes, there were two on one occasion, not on this particular, or it might have been this convoy, there were two Russian ships came out. Now, this is absolutely true, and I can't tell you any more than this. We sighted two Russian destroyers coming out to meet us. And we were having a hell of a ding-dong battle, you know, it was really all guns blasting, you know, and firing away at the aircraft. And it was a real battle, roar going, and then they disappeared. We didn't see them. And I can only go by rumour. I can't do it because you know what, but rumour has it that these two Russian destroyer commanders, what had happened, they'd seen the battle in the distance, all the and decided that, what is that word? Discretion is the better part of valour, and they didn't come and join us. I can't say you blame them, but I understand that Captain Onslow had to attend the Russian court-martial over it, and I believe, I don't know what happened. I would think 10-1 on they would be dealt with in the summary manner which Russians did deal with people who turned who didn't do their stuff. So that's as far as I know. But that's all the things that go on in the war. In a war, you know, you can't verify them, but you can only. But quite definitely, there were two puffs of smoke, you know, on the horizon. We said, oh yes, it's coming from. They were coming from the direction of, then they disappeared. So what happened to them? I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine.
On returning from that particular convoy, what happened to you then?
We went straight back to Murmansk and re-ammunition ship, oiled ship.
You mentioned Murmansk.
Back to Iceland. Brought the convoy back, the other convoy. The usually parted company, sort of north of the Orkneys there, you know, they come down and we went up to, we would go back to our base at
Iceland,
yes, Seyðisfjörður. And but then, after, I think, was it this one, or was it the convoy afterwards, we got a bit of, you know, every destroyer has to have a boiler clean, because the boilers get choked up. So we had to go for a boiler clean. Now sometimes this can, if you're unlucky, can happen in a dry dock, away from home, but they took us back to Rosyth, and gave us 72 hours leave. Each watch got 72 hours leave from Rosyth to get the boilers cleaned. And I don't know if I've mentioned, but all the destroyers, the tribal class destroyers, were adopted by a lady called Auntie May. Her name was May Hanrahan, and she was a very rich millionaire in New York from the beginning of the war. And the reason was because she married an Englishman, who had been a captain of a tribal class destroyer in the First World War. So she'd adopted all the tribals, and we used to get all these wonderful parcels with Lucky Strikes, because I used to smoke then, you know, Lucky Strikes and Philip Morris and all sorts of wonderful things she used to send to the tribals, every tribal that was in the war. Because I'll tell you a story. When I came back, somebody was telling me, trying to swing the lamp. I went to a pub called the Nag's Head in Welling, and this chap was trying to swing the lamp about what he was on. I said, "Oh, I said you were on the tribals." He says, "Oh, I used this sailor was swinging. It was in the navy, you know." So says, "I said, oh yeah." I said, "You were on the tribals." What do you think of Auntie May? Now, it was a test word. It was he says, "Auntie May, who's Auntie May?" I says, "You were never on a tribal." I said, "I'm telling you now, because everybody who was on a tribal, we used to look forward to the parcels from Auntie May, and everybody knew Auntie May. Auntie May was an American, and who was much loved by all the men in the tribal class destroyers, and that's a fact. Never seen that in a book, but I'm telling you now, it's true." And so I went on leave, and the Russia and
Did you get home?
Yeah, got home. Got home to Welling, and when I went home, there were blooming guns firing. It was terrible. There were guns firing and bombs dropping and all sorts of wonderful things. And I thought, to hell with this. I'd rather be behind the bloody gun than the booth. This is no good. I can't hit back. I mean, when you're on a ship, you can hit back. You can give them as good as you get.
Your parents were in more danger than you were.
That's right. In a sense, they were. Yeah. Well, by George, they were. Welling was just on the outskirts of London, and they were getting bashed, but not as much as central London. And the funny thing was that, God, talk about hilarious. When we got back, going back to Rosyth, I tell you a funny thing. It was because of the bombing and all that. King's Cross, we had to go to get the train from King's Cross, and they'd cancelled the train. The last train was at midnight, you see. And they'd cancelled the train, and the next one was at 5 a.m. Well, as a result of this, all the people on that train, and I was one of them, and we noticed that Captain Onslow was on the same train, you see. He, same as us, he couldn't get the train, it resulted that whilst I had to be back aboard at 08:00 in the morning, I was just actually getting on, like about 50 or 60 other sailors getting on the train. Well, we got aboard, and the following day, this is hilarious, this is the Navy for you. So we were all, names taken, you know, for being late on board, you see, all the ships, of course, the official title of it is, and we're all in the rattle anyway. And we were coming up before Captain Onslow, you see, off cap, did come aboard 8 hours late or something like that. And Onslow had been on the same train. He said, any excuse? Well, yes, sir. I said, the train was cancelled. He said, that's no excuse. But sir, nobody said, one day's pay, one day's leave. I got one day's pay, one day's leave stopped. And you know what the crafty said? Do you know what it was? And there was about 50 of us all in the line, all got one day's pay, one day's leave stopped for being on this train, being late. And the funny thing was, they wanted somebody to paint ship, didn't they? So all the Janker men, that was us, like the one day's pay, that was how we spent to paint the ship. They had about 40 people with paintbrushes painting the ship. It was so funny, but you've got to laugh at these things. It was nothing serious.
Rosyth a good base to be in?
Oh, yeah, it was a proper naval base. I mean, you had to be careful because they had great big dry docks there, and that you could get boiler cleaning and scaling in the underneath the part of the ship, you know, the keel, cleaning the keel and that sort of thing. You've got all of that kind of thing at Rosyth, and all equipment. It was a wonderful base, actually. And we used to go to shore to Dunfermline, the dumps, and we used to go up to Fairley's Bar, did some fighting there, actually. And there's a fellow called Merton on board. He got me and one of my run ashore pals, you mentioned just now, couldn't think, was Lofty Cooper. He was a great big Newfie, a Newfoundlander. And we had, in the same mess, was a fellow called leading seaman Peak, Crash Peak. And he was a New Zealander. And we didn't know, well, at least I didn't know, that the colonials hated each other's guts. No, I did not realise this until I was on the Ashanti. And one day, on the Ashanti, Lofty Cooper was peeling spuds. And he was a fisherman from Newfoundland. He was a big, long, gaunt fella. But Crash Peak had been a New Zealand all-black rugby player. He was a big, strapping chap, like, you know. And Pete was absolutely riding, you know, giving Lofty Cooper some stick while he's peeling his spouse. Because I told you, he was cook of the mess, you see. Lofty Cooper dropped his knife and his potato, like that, and he just stood up, and he punched Crash Pete on the jaw. Like that. And Crash Peak sailed right along the top of the table and landed in a heap the other side. And Lofty just got down and started peeling his butts again. Well, now, to Peak's credit, it never went aft. you know what I mean? He was a leading seaman. He could have taken Lofty to task and said, go and get after this and report it. But he didn't. It ended there. But because Lofty, Class Pete had been riding him. But Lofty was a handful. It was Lofty Cooper was, I went ashore with him once or twice. And he was a real tough guy. And he was thin as a rake. And as I said, he was about 6 foot tall. And he was a lovely, very quiet drawl of a fellow. He had American drawl, you know, like Newfies have, you know. And Lofty and I were in a bar. I think it was called Fairley's Bar. Was it Fairley's Bar? Something bar. It was in Edinburgh, anyway. And we were in this bar, and there were five or six guardsmen came in. We were just having a drink, Lofty and I. A fellow called Merton came in off the ship. And Merton was a big mouth, you know, big, well, you get them in everywhere. And he said, so, you know, let's take these, let's get these pongos. They called them, soldiers all called pongos, you know, the Navy called them pongos. Let's have a go at these pongos. So anyway, they were minding their own business. They weren't bothering us, and we weren't bothering them. Then Merton came in. So anyway, he sits down and has this drinks with us. You see, there was just three of us, and there was five or six of them. This fellow stood up in the guards office, whatever he was. He was a soldier anyway. I think he was in the guards, and he was about 6 foot 6, and he came across. So he says. He says, I gather that, words to the effect, that gather you fellas are fancying your chances. So anyway, I said, no, we're just sort of, we're all right. So he got a hold of me by the front of the thing, and he lifted me up, and he lifted me clean, with one hand, this soldier, lifted me clean out of the seat, lifted about 3 feet in the air, and he drew his hand back. And then I landed in the seat because Lofty had stood up and hit him. And when Lofty hit anybody, that was good night. Well, the set to that they had, I ended up unconscious. But Lofty, apparently they told me, some of the sailors came in and sorted things out. But what had happened was these soldiers had said about, and I was knocked unconscious, and Lofty was standing over the top of me, sort of battling on. Because he was a fisherman, you know, and he was absolutely really hard.
Was there a shore police?
Oh, patrol, yeah. Patrol, but we didn't get much of that not at that time of the war. It didn't affect us much, but you affect it. You do feel it when on shore patrol. There's always naval pickets. They come from big ships and shore depths, cruisers and above, and battleships, they provide shore pickets, you know. They go aboard, a dozen of them, you know, sort of go aboard to lock up all the sailors or anybody who's drunk, because you see the sailors rolling in the gutter drunk as lords, you know, or fighting like we were. But we got away with it anyway.
Was there any opportunity for sport when you were in the
base? Oh, yes, absolutely. When you're a base, as soon as you got in, more or less, they were all organising. The officers used to organise, and the POs used to organise the ship's teams. And at that time, we were a very good rugby team, actually, because we had about six Welsh internationals, were Bryn Jones, and we had Crash Peak, you know, the fellow who I said, he was an all-black man, and we had Terry Lewin, who had played for the Navy, and Tony Bailey, who was also a good rugby player, and me, I got my colours at Shotley, so we had a fairly good... We had a fairly good rugby team, you know. We never got beat, never.
Inter-ship competitions.
Yes, that's right. We used to play different ships, you know. And we played battleships and all sorts, and cruisers. We met them, you know, on the rugby. And everyone, the Shanty had a terrific rugby team. They were really terrific. Very little ship, but poor dear me. There's all these ships with about 2,000 men on them. Because there's a lot of men to choose from, they had.